Dior Talks. Welcome to the Dior Talks podcast series dedicated to the 8th edition of Dior Lady Art, hosted by Paris-based journalist Katia Forman. For this highly anticipated edition, 12 artists from around the world were invited to transform the iconic Lady Dior handbag into a unique work of art. In this episode, we enter the universe of London-based Canadian-Korean artist Zadie Cha, a transporting, enigmatic world informed by notions of self and Cha's experiences within the Korean diaspora. Influences range from folklore, speculative fiction, and systems of power, to the supernatural, ancient religions, and the climate crisis. For her multimedia installations, the artist often incorporates richly patterned garments, mixing streetwear codes with nods to ceremonial wear and ancestral traditions. For Dior Lady Art, Cha dreamed up four bags featuring vibrant geometric patchworks inspired by pojegi, a traditional Korean wrapping cloth, as well as ornate mother-of-pearl applications that paid tribute to the ancient Korean handicraft of Naeonjeon Chilgi. Rings of mother-of-pearl, edged with flames, give on to scenes depicting animals often found in her work, such as the fox, the orca, and the seagull, here holding a small planet in its beak. Tune in to the episode to hear more about the artist's colourful and layered Dior Lady Art creations. On the latest episode of the Dior Talk series dedicated to the 8th edition of Dior Lady Art, we enter the fascinating world of Zadie Cha. The Canadian-Korean visual artist creates immersive multimedia and multi-sensory experiences, blending textiles, sound, painting, sculpture, and live performance. Here we hear all about Cha's Dior Lady Art experience and how she fused her universe with the Lady Dior. So Zadie, where is home for you and what are your origins?
Well, I guess in the sense of where I'm living at the moment, I live in East London and I've been here for about 11 years in London, various places around the city. Okay. And I'm originally from Vancouver, Canada, and my family is from South Korea.
Okay, great. And where's your studio based? Do you work from home?
So my studio is also in East London. I'm in between Poplar and Bow, and I live about, you know, a 10-minute walk from there as well.
So tell me, Zadie, what are you wearing today? The reason I'm asking that question is I saw the Dior video of you presenting your bags and you were wearing this black scorpion t-shirt.
Yes.
But tell us a bit about your relationship to clothes and fashion. I believe you use textiles and clothing in your performances, and I read that you create these very richly patterned items of clothing that you call magical garments.
You know, I've always really been interested in clothes, I think particularly from the perspective of, you know, how we choose to be seen and how we want to be seen by others. And I think this was something that I was very much aware of even as a young person. I think a lot of young people, teenagers, were very preoccupied with what we look like and what people think about us. And as I got older, I started to think about the ways in which folk traditions, folk clothing, traditional regalia, be it religious or cultural, has always had that signification as well, right? So in a lot of traditional clothing, a lot of the symbols or stitches or embroidery will inevitably tell people around the wearers who these people are, where they're from, who their family members are. And so I liken that to this idea of brand names, but also, I suppose, the way in which I grew up in the late 90s, early 2000s, in snowboard and skateboard culture, this desire to put different patches on your jacket or snowboard or backpack as a young person, you know, to signify to those around you the kind of music that you're interested in, the kind of brand names that you think are cool and identify with. Because I think ultimately, you know, these are emblems of words or, you know, pieces of information that kind of describe the story of who you want to be. And so with that thinking, it also comes into this question of the wearer and the power that the wearer yields. So, you know, I liken this to this idea of superheroes in comic books are often wear capes, or magicians, witches or warlocks. These are things that enable those figures to embody that supernatural power. Uh-huh. But if you look around you as well and you think of other positions of power, like the Pope, for example, or Catholic priests, I grew up Catholic. So this is kind of, I think, where it might have started. You see very ornate robes, which also are meant to signify to those attending Mass, you know, who's in charge basically of the story that day. So I think that idea of clothes operating with that type of energy has always been very interesting to me from an everyday perspective in terms of what we choose to wear or what we have to wear, depending on who we want to be that day.
What are you wearing today, Zayde?
I'm not in my pajamas, but I will say when I am off duty, as in I don't have to be seen by, you know, anyone in public and I'm going to my studio, especially in the fall, I'm wearing two pairs of Uniqlo thermal trousers and shirts because I'm freezing. So I've not yet put on my outfit.
It's all about function and comfort.
It is when I'm not going out. And, you know, I'm someone who actually, I really, really love fashion. I really love clothes. I feel like that's kind of my external hobby. I like to have things that I really love wearing, but I will say that I feel really embarrassed. I think I'm much more practical these days. So I'll collect all these things. I'll wear them when I go out very occasionally, but oftentimes I'm really looking like I'm going to, you know, a camping site, track pants, a vest, down vest, just so that I don't, you know, I'm not cold in the studio. So
before we talk about your bags, take us into your artistic universe. Can we find these crossovers of street and tradition in your works?
Yeah, so I think absolutely. When I'm working with textiles, I mean, the way that started for me after I graduated grad school was to think directly about clothing that I was interested in when I was a young person. So kind of large, you know, baggy jackets. I really liked large silhouettes. I think this comes from my time as you know, someone who was very heavily invested in snowboard culture. So I thought about these kind of street style jackets that I would wear when I was a teenager. And that's kind of how it started. I was really looking at the clothing around me. But soon that drifted into this idea of traditional clothing, particularly I was interested, and I still am, in Korean shamanic outerwear, because I think similarly to Catholic priests or the Pope, you essentially have the person who is heralding the ritual with these really ornate jackets, again, which signify to those around this person what position of power they're taking at that moment. And so I think for me now, I'm trying to mix both of them because I don't actually always want the references to be so explicit, especially with clothing. I think sometimes they teeter between this idea of, you know, outerwear that you might see on the streets today, but also mix in with my interest in traditional Korean silhouettes. And then another thing I'm really interested in is Korean patchwork. So if you look at this type of textile work, it kind of, I mean, for me as a younger person, when I came across it, it reminded me a lot of American modernist geometric painting or European geometric painting. Mm-hmm. And I think similarly to a lot of quilting communities globally, or in particular the Gee's Bend quilters in Alabama, you can look at the way in which geometric abstraction has been used by folks who have not always been considered at the epicenter of, you know, high art. And, you know, in many cases earlier than, you know, some, you know, modernist painters have been experimenting with shape and form in this way. So I think for me as an artist who, you know, went to Western institutions, it's really important that this center becomes expanded in terms of where the reference points lie. So rather than looking only at like a Rothko or Mondrian or Paul Klee, artists who I admire and really like, you know, for me, it's important to look at, let's say, Korean craft made by people who, you know, are essentially not recorded in time as being these artists. They were kind of, we would consider them to, you know, be anonymous. We don't know. But to look at the kind of design work or craftsmanship that these people were engaging in with form and shape, rather than only looking to artists who, you know, we're constantly told are at the center of genius. So it's important for me that these two histories lie side by side and have parallel conversations.
And having grown up in Canada and incorporating all of these references to Korean traditions, is it for you also a way of looking to reconcile or reconnect with your ancestors?
Yes, I think for me and probably a lot of folks whose family backgrounds stem from immigration or migration, particularly maybe from a North American lens. I'm sure it's happening in the UK as well. You know, when I was a young person, I never felt like it was cool to be from Korean heritage, which is obviously, you know, the opposite now. It's kind of shocking to witness. It's incredible how, you know, the soft cultural power of South Korea has kind of extended itself globally.
Yeah, I mean, all of the obsession with the Korean groups, it's just insane. It's like the Beatles.
It is amazing. Yes, it's amazing to see. I mean, I think because I'm older and it doesn't affect me in the same way, I'm looking at it very much from an outsider, almost like as an anthropologist. But as a young person, I absolutely felt, disconnected, maybe almost on purpose. Like there was a severing of not wanting to be, you know, associated with anything to do that was different, because as a young person, you're so desperate to be accepted and to assimilate into mainstream culture, which for me at the time was, you know, very much, you know, white suburban snowboard culture. And so I think as I got older and I was studying, I became very invested in this idea of painting. And then, you know, painting can sometimes be very inward looking. And so I suppose whilst I was very invested in that, I was thinking a lot about the gaze. I was thinking about Orientalist practices within European painting in like the 19th century and thinking about how to deconstruct those ideas of exoticism. But, you know, as I got a little bit older, I realized that a lot of this subject matter was very distant from me. And, you know, I thought there was better ways in which I could be a bit more direct with the subject matter. And I suppose this is in a way when I started to just look at traditional Korean craft and artwork. And I always mention craft because I think there is something about the work of common folks, people who are not considered artists, that is very important for me. And just, you know, it's, I suppose, the language of everyday folks that resonates more with me because of this innate hierarchy that art often puts upon its makers and people who are considered of higher ilk. So I suppose in many ways in the beginning it was, you know, more of an institutional, not critique necessarily, but a way in which I could position myself as, okay, I'm going to impose this kind of active refusal to look at, oh, you know, one type of historical framing for the artwork that I'm now engaging with. I'd like to expand that. But, you know, as I start getting closer to that, inevitably you think about where you come from, how you chose to identify as a young person, again, like, you know, being very aware of how people see you. And then I guess in a very mild way, as an act of refusal or rebellion, yes, very much wanting to engage explicitly with things that were overtly Korean looking, I suppose from a Western perspective in the art world, it kind of was this thing where I was making this explicit choice because I'm not from Korea, right? So it was a choice to make my work look a certain way. And then, of course, as you say, you know, when you start delving a little bit deeper into that research, there is a connection to family. And one often will think about, you know, your ancestors. And I suppose there is this longing to have a connection that maybe when I was younger, I definitely didn't allow myself to embrace in the same way that I'm choosing to now.
To switch back to clothes and fashion, what was it like getting the call to participate on the Dior Lady Art series?
You know, it's something that actually I've been wanting to do for a long time. So I remember I met another artist who has participated in the Dior bag collection a few times, and I was lucky enough to hold the bag that she had made, and I just thought, this is such an incredible sculpture. This is the only thing I thought was, this is not like a handbag, this is a sculpture. And I think because of my natural draw to fashion and the way in which things are designed, because, you know, art making is very different than design. There's different outcomes and different ways of production and all sorts of stuff. And so just to be involved in that, I thought that would be the dream. And so when I was invited to do it, of course I was thrilled. But, you know, to my, I don't know if surprise is the right word, but as a total fashion outsider and someone who works within, you know, the art industry, it was amazing to have carte blanche of what I could do. There was no restrictions or kind of corporate remit in terms of, you know, what should be done or what could be avoided. You know, it was very much, we'd love for you to do whatever you want and the sky is the limit. And I think for an artist, particularly someone like myself, to have that opportunity where, you know, they're going to support you with all types of production or whatever idea you have is amazing. And to be able to work with people who have such knowledge and skill with materials was honestly a really incredible experience.
So now we would love to hear descriptions of your bags, which are absolutely stunning. But could you take us through them and some of the techniques that we use? Now, you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation. For example, the mother of pearl inlaying, Nadjonchilgi, is that correct?
I would say it very similar to you with a North American accent, so it's not going to sound better.
I'm relieved.
So, you know, I think, I believe all of the bags have a little bit of this mother of pearl inlay. And the reason why I really wanted to incorporate this is because there are these East Asian jewelry boxes or pieces of furniture that I think most people will have seen. I think mother of pearl inlay is very popular in a lot of different cultures. But for me, when I was growing up, I remember we had a few pieces of furniture in my mother's house with this inlay, and I was always really attracted to these objects. So essentially, you usually see them in black lacquer, and they will have kind of ornate pictures of flowers or different kind of landscape scenes with animals. Almost like a, you know, red is like a storybook. For me, this is how I interpret it as a young person. And so I think for me, it's very much a reminder of my youth or my childhood growing up with my mom and having objects in and around the house that spoke to me as being very Korean or authentically from where my family originates. And so I wanted to have that superimposed onto the bags. One, because it was a nostalgic reminder for me. But two, oftentimes, you know, these jewelry boxes or pieces of furniture that would hold important items like jewelry or clothes or other things that you would want to keep. And so I just thought this was the perfect thing because you essentially have almost like a jewelry box with the Lady Dior bag, and it's something that you would put precious objects that you carry day to day into. And so I wanted it to have this really ornate feel that on one hand is traditional, but of course, you know, it mixes in with other elements of the design, which, you know, are very much direct references from one-of-a-kind artworks that I've made. So
you've got this mother of pearl on the handles and also edging the bags, but also you have on one side of the bags these rings of mother of pearl that give on to a little landscape like portals almost. Tell us a bit about what we see inside these rings, these animals. We have the killer whale, the seagull, a fox, and a tiger.
It's funny because, you know, I chose the seagull not only for, you know, the bag, but actually I'm often using different animals as symbols within my work. And the seagull is a creature that I've been thinking about for the past few years, I think particularly around COVID, because I have a colony of gulls above my studio. But because I am from Vancouver and it is, a port city, I'm used to having seagulls. You know, their calls remind me of being home. But also seagulls, like foxes here in the UK, or pigeons and sometimes crows, they're often animals that people who live in urban settings are used to. So this is the nature that I'm used to seeing all the time. But also I feel quite an affinity with these animals because they are in many ways scavengers. They are kind of the underclass of animals that humans often, you know, have great disdain for. They need to be very clever in order to ensure their survival in and around us, because ultimately I think they depend on kind of our garbage or our detritus to survive. But also in a way, you know, it is us who are also infringing upon their territories. So there's a little bit of a clash there. So I think any type of creature or character that is essentially underdog, I'm very much attached to, or I have feelings of affection and empathy for.
Does the seagull have something in his beak? Because the fox is looking at him.
Yes. So I'm not sure if it's so visible, but there is a small planet in his beak. So Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that image is actually from previous paintings of mine that I've had in other exhibitions. And actually, that's where the tiger and the shell come from. And I think the two orcas are also images from other paintings that I've worked with. And again, as I said, I'm really interested in animals serving as kind of symbols within my work. Oftentimes, they allude to other ideas that I'm thinking about socially, politically, but also it's because I myself have a relationship with these animals because of whatever they might mean to me and who I feel like I am or where I'm from. So I'm from Vancouver, and you know, even our hockey team, it's depicted by a killer whale, an orca. And I think that the very first sculpture I'd ever seen, probably as a one-year-old, is this beautiful sculpture of an orca by the artist Bill Reed that sits outside of the Vancouver Aquarium. And I have a photo of myself with this sculpture and my mom. It's a perfect emblem for Vancouver, and it means so much to the people that that live there. So, you know, I worked on a project a few years ago. I think it was debuted at the Venice Biennial, where I was really thinking about orcas and orca communities and their social structures. And it's kind of stayed as a symbol that I have been thinking about, particularly with regards to matrilineal social structures. I'm not sure if you know, but orcas are led by their grandmothers and mothers. So this is another common theme within my work, this relationship within family.
And you have these flames licking around the rings. What do they symbolize?
So, you know, I think for me earlier on in my work, I had mentioned a little bit about these jackets worn by Korean shamans. And I think for me, in my own lexicon of symbols, I guess this idea of fire being something globally understood as being destructive, but also as like a purifier, something that is a symbol of power. Within previous textile works of mine, I'd always had this kind of silhouettes of flames around the edges of the collars of where the neckline is or where your wrist line is. And so within the bag, I just wanted to frame again, I suppose, this again, another emblem of power. I think in many ways, these bags are meant to kind of embolden the person carrying them as their little magic bag. So I suppose it's a little bit of that, you know, placed within that object.
If we turn the bag around, we have this beautiful patchworking or collage of fabrics, colorful fabrics. And that, I believe, is a reference to pojegi. Is that how you pronounce it? The Korean wrapping cloth?
That's right. Yeah. It very much goes in line with my interest in looking at, I suppose, more invisibilized artistic voices in the past. And yeah, you know, Korean pojegi comes from, I suppose, women's village work in the past, where people would, you know, collect bits of leftover discarded fabric and create something new, very much like other quilting communities.
Right.
And so the backs of those bags are actually based on other larger textile works that I have had in other exhibitions. So I wanted very much for each bag to kind of represent different phases in my practice so far. And so not only were these kind of bags, you know, devised or designed to present something new and special, but I really wanted them to reflect different moments or exhibitions I'd had in the past.
To switch back to Dior, what does the Lady Dior symbolize for you?
I think that the bag is timeless, it's elegant, it's simple, it's chic. I think it's a real marker of style. I think it can be worn with a dressed up outfit and a pair of jeans and sneakers. And, you know, to be honest with you, when I'd first been invited to do the collaboration, my first thought was Ursula K. Le Guin's story about the carrier bag theory of fiction. So there is this idea that instead of carrying a weapon for survival, that perhaps the object that would be carried by this person would be a bag, you know, a bag that would carry seeds that you could grow your own food. You could carry other objects in it that would redefine technology as a way to ensure survival. So instead of carrying something that would perpetuate violence, you carry something that, you know, essentially a sack that carries other objects of survival. And so for me, I suppose in many ways, I was thinking about it almost from that speculative fiction lens of carrying a bag that you would essentially put all of your daily necessities in. So I was almost thinking about the bag. It's very utilitarian. It's this perfect, beautiful kind of square object that you're able to place a lot of things in. It's soft, but at the same time, it has a lot of structure and it's hard and it's a strong thing. So that's kind of how I see it. It's a perfect balance of the both.
Are there any hidden references or messages in your bags?
There are. So there are a few special charms inside the bag where you would open up the zipper. And inside each bag, there is a different color to the leather on the inside, which is supposed to emanate light. If you open up the bag, you will see there are special hidden things on the inside. And ultimately, I hope that these bags bring good luck, good fortune and protection for the person that is carrying it.
To go back to the House of Dior, I don't know if you've followed any of Maria Grazia Chiuri's collaborations with female artists, but what do you think about her support of women artists and inviting them to create sets for her shows?
That's actually probably one of the biggest pulls into wanting to work with Dior, especially as an artist. And probably a reason why a lot of artists are quite drawn to working with Dior. I mean, I think it's phenomenal. If you look at a lot of fashion houses, there are choices that people make. People choose who they want to work with and they choose who they platform. And if you look at the artists that she has chosen to work with, not all of them are, you know, the superstar, huge artists that everyone knows. I think she's choosing on instinct, choosing artists that are interesting to her that might have a reach in different demographics. But I also think it's an incredibly generous thing to do when you are in a position of power and you choose to extend that power to help shine light onto practices that are not so widely known. You know, of course, as artists, we have our own audiences, but being part of something with such a global reach like Dior is something that even the biggest artists are not able to get, because ultimately working in the art world is a niche community. So I think it's a testament to her generosity and a real desire to speak to this sisterhood as she talks about with a lot of artists. So I actually think it's phenomenal, very, very generous. And as I said, authentic.
Thank you, Zadie. For the listeners or for any other artists who are listening out there that might want to do this in the future, what was your favorite part of this experience?
Oh my gosh. I think for artists, process is very important. Oftentimes, deadlines can be really stressful and you want to get to the end thing right away and just forget about the stressfulness of making. But, you know, for me, I was amazed at how not stressful this entire situation was and how fun and playful, because ultimately I think that the team at Dior was so helpful, organized, knowledgeable about, you know, the way in which I was working. I just feel like that entire process was so fun, and I don't have one, you know, aspect of it that was the most exciting. I just think it's being presented with all of these different options that very much tailored to what the artist's initial idea is, was the most exciting. Of course, to see the prototypes is amazing as well, but it's every step of the way. To be able to see how things are essentially, you know, put together through the eyes of other people, but very much through the perspective of the artist, is really amazing. It's almost uncanny in a way, because you're looking at an object that's made within this kind of iconic, you know, fashion brand with this very iconic silhouette, but it is very much a reflection of my work. This is how I think about it. So it's kind of a strange thing to have this thing that was created essentially by other people, you know, through your own instruction, but something that looks like you made it. So, I mean, it really is like a jewel. Every little piece, there is no way in which there was a shortcut to produce the bags that I made. I was impressed because I feel like they are handmade. They are, if I had the tools and the ability, it's exactly the way in which I would have made them. So it was a really amazing experience.